And we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov, Althea Billings, and Eliza Yurkov. The producer is Eliza Yurkov, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Brian Bull, Alex Gonzalez, Mike Moen, Crystal Blair, Kathleen Shannon, Roz Brown, Edwin J. Vieira, and Tramel Gomes. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
I'm Don Merrill, and I'm talking with Maxine Dexter. Ms. Dexter is running for the U.S. House in Oregon's 3rd Congressional District. Ms. Dexter, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk with you.
Ms. Dexter, I guess the first question I had for you, ma'am, is why do you want to be in the U.S. House of Representatives? I mean, being a doctor is a pretty good gig, isn't it?
It is a good gig, and it's been the privilege of my life, quite frankly, to take care of people. But what I'm seeing is that my patients are struggling with impossible decisions, whether they take the medication that I'm prescribing or get the tests that I'm ordering versus paying rent or paying for childcare. What I want to do is make an impact on the health and wellness of my community, and I can do that more effectively in office than I can in a whole career as a physician, as much as that pains me to say. I very much believe that's the reality at this point in time.
So why does it pain you to say it?
Because I love my job. You know, I worked my whole life towards a goal of being a physician, and it gives me great personal satisfaction to lay hands on a person and help them heal and to interact in a very personal, one-on-one way. That fills my cup. But we see across our community too many people struggling and not enough people who are courageously leading, not because of personal gain, but because of the people that they need to serve in their communities. And so rather than continue to be critical of the people who are serving us in Congress, I felt like it was time for me to put myself forward and take that on. And it's not working for people right now.
I had read that your intention is to continue working in the healthcare field even as you're a congresswoman. Is that right?
Legally, you're not able to earn over a very modest amount of money in addition to your federal position. So the taxpayers are paying for you to be a full-time lawmaker. That is the job. But I will volunteer and continue to serve in that way. How that's going to look is still to be determined.
Okay. When you were appointed to Mitch Greenlich's seat after his death in 2020, had you always had political ambitions?
My dad told me that I told him when I was in high school that I would be the head of the WHO one day. I always knew I wanted to work in healthcare policy. My grandmother struggled with diabetes and the progressive, devastating nature of diabetes and didn't have optimal health care. So I had seen that firsthand throughout my growing up and wanted to take care of people. So health care was always where I was going to go. I wanted to be a doctor from the time I was in fifth grade. So it was never about politics. It was always about policy. Like, why can't we take care of everyone in our communities?
You decided to run for the Oregon House after Brett Kavanaugh had his hearings. What about them inspired you to seek office?
Yeah, it was really that feeling of one, quite frankly, rage. Seeing a woman who I very much identified with, who had been impacted by poor decisions by Mr. Kavanaugh, Justice Kavanaugh, I should say, And we didn't trust her, listen to her, believe her in the same way that we didn't trust or listen or believe Anita Hill many years before. And it felt like we just continued to marginalize women. And I could see the writing on the wall with the long-term plan that was clearly out there for people who wanted to kill our right to have reproductive freedom in this country. And once again, it was, if not me, who? And if not now, when? And honestly, I thought I was going to run for school board or something. I just knew I needed to get myself out there. And then it ended up being Mitch Greenlicks.
But there are a lot of people in office who hold political ideologies that are based on populist ideas. How are you going to navigate those people to get your policies to vote?
Yeah, you know, the reality is that science is real and data, when done well, and you can analyze if data is collected in a reliable and meaningful way. Not all data are, as you know. Science is hard to argue with if you really believe in facts. And I think that the alternative facts reality is challenging and the ideologies are compelling for some people. But we need to back up and just get back to dealing with the reality of what's in front of us, climate change. We are impacted by this every day across this country at this point. We have to start just backing up and dealing again with real science. And so that is something, it's a discipline I've spent my whole life practicing. There's no chance that I'm not going to be compelled much more by data than by someone's ideology. And I hope, I am an eternal optimist. My son calls me annoyingly optimistic. I have to believe that we can see our own futures at risk here and that we will start behaving in a way that's consistent with our survival. And not just survival, but we need to start thinking about thriving again, not just struggling to survive.
Well, you know, there are a lot of economic interests that are perfectly happy with things continuing as they are. And I know in general, it's important to say we need to find a way to work with people across the aisle. But I mean, practically, how will you do it?
Our economy has to be about people. And until the American economy is strongest when our middle class is the biggest, you know, as we expand the middle class and people have stability, our economy thrives. I grew up in a working class family, first and only to go to college. We need to make sure that that opportunity is available to everyone. And I don't see that right now. I was working a part-time union job, paying my way through school and able to afford housing in the city of Seattle. There's not a person who can work a part-time entry-level job and do that in Portland and probably in most parts of the country right now. That has to be accessible for us to have our own self-interest invested in the economy. When people see opportunity, they will aspire and work towards it. What we have is a feeling of hopelessness amongst many. My kids are 18 and 20, and there's a lot of people in their age group who, one, don't know that they can afford college, and two, don't think they'll ever own a home of their own or have stable housing. Like, that's got to change. And so until the economy supports people having that aspirational opportunity, we will continue to, as you say, those who benefit from their suffering will continue to reign, and we have to strengthen that. That includes a well-funded public school system that helps people understand the realities of the economy and how to engage. How to work across the aisle is really grounded in values. We all want to live in safe and healthy communities. We want to feel safe when we're walking down our streets. We can build on those shared values. I think there's far less that divides us than holds us together. But unfortunately, we're so diverted into these areas of divisiveness that we have lost that ability to cross the aisle. And honestly, at the Oregon legislature, I feel like that was much more of the Oregon way is really working towards what is benefiting all Oregonians. That has been a mantra that is really held tight in the Oregon legislature. I have to believe that congressional leaders are there because they want to serve and give them the benefit of the doubt and reach across the aisle. And that's how I'll show up, is giving people people the benefit of the doubt, trusting but verifying, and then just building on the things that our community needs.
You've got, I have a loved one currently who's in a local hospital facing something life-threatening, and I've noticed the nursing staff, though it's dedicated, is understaffed. Their facilities are antiquated. I see equipment deficiencies. As a physician representing the U.S. House in the 3rd District, is there anything you can do to address those issues?
Yeah, we've tried for the staffing level. We've tried to do that at the state level. We passed a safe staffing law just in the 2023 legislative session that is just now getting implemented across the state, and it's not being implemented in an optimal way yet. We still do not see the staffing levels that we need and that we're required by the law. It's a rolling up policy, so all local hospitals are under that same policy to have safe staffing. Our healthcare teams are absolutely understaffed. They are overstressed. COVID has taken a toll. People don't trust the healthcare system in the same way. These are mission-driven people. They go into healthcare because they want to care for people. I think that's almost universal across this. And what we know about that, in the same way that it's true for educators, is you can tap those people, and because they feel that mission and they want to serve, they will continue to work and work and work and overwork. The system benefits from our labor in that regard until you burn out and then you leave. And that is unfortunately what we've seen. And we're seeing physician shortages. We see people retiring early, nursing leaving the intensive care unit and the really labor challenged areas where if nurses don't feel and staff don't feel safe, like they're delivering safe care, that erosion of their moral sort of drive is very real and personal. So they will step away.
Next question. I know that you have a clear stance on gun control. You know, you advocate for stricter laws to reduce gun violence, and you've always aligned yourself with progressive values. But given that Oregon has both urban areas with high support for gun control and rural areas who oppose it, how are you going to face the pushback from the more conservative and rural constituents, especially in the broader 3rd District? How are you going to balance your stance on gun control with the need to represent more conservative voices that may create some tension?
No, I really appreciate the question. It's an age-old issue in the United States and will continue to be, most likely. I believe gun violence is a public health issue. And when there were escalating motor vehicle accidents, we did things like require insurance and licensing and training, and you have to actually pass the ability to operate the vehicle to be able to use it. We have not done any of those interventions on a federal scale for guns, and we don't say you can't have a car. We just say you have to safely use your car. I believe that most gun owners, and the data will support this, that most gun owners want safe gun use to be legal. We're not trying to take away guns. We're trying to make them safe. The idea that safe storage is not a universal policy across this country means that children can access guns. They're interested in them. I raised small kids. They pretended that sticks were guns. You know, this is natural, interesting, like, things to them. When they see a gun, they're going to play with it. And we don't have a federal law saying that safe storage is mandatory. We don't have background checks from a legal standpoint, but also if you have a red flag law saying that this person is homicidal or suicidal, that they shouldn't be able to buy a gun. We know that these things are just common sense issues that most rural Americans, if they are clear that hunting and using their guns for self-protection is not being threatened, will be supportive. And even in my debate with Joanna Harbor, who is running against me for the seat, we found areas of alignment for safe safety with guns. So I do believe we can build on this. They passed the first federal law in 30 years just recently with the Biden-Harris administration. We can continue to build on that. We have to be able to send our kids to a safe place and not worry that there's threat of gun violence in those areas.
You have strong pro-choice stances, and you advocate for expanding reproductive rights and protecting the LGBTQ community, and your position on these issues, you know, resonates with a lot of progressive voters. But in a diverse district like the 3rd, you know, some more moderate or conservative constituents may be less supportive of those positions. And while you have, you know, a clear progressive base representing the entire district might be more of a nuanced approach, which could be seen as conflicting with firm ideological values. So how do you navigate that?
Yeah, I think the personal autonomy, our civil rights to have agency over our bodies, is first and foremost. We cannot and should not have politicians in the exam rooms with us navigating very challenging personal decisions around health and healthcare. That is a decision for a patient with the advice of their healthcare team. That is something that I don't think most people are going to have issue with. If you just look at the principle, when you start talking about what people are doing and having, you know, challenges with gender affirming care or abortion, we aren't all going to agree on what is right for me or what's right for you. And so are we going to micromanage and allow for that creep of politicians telling us what to do? It's just a matter of time until it's less and less free in this country if we allow for that civil liberty to be encroached upon. So I think we just get back to the principles that we should not, as politicians, be telling people what they can or cannot do with their bodies as long as they're not threatening others. And I think that that is really the foundational. Whether or not you want a gender-affirming treatment is not going to harm or threaten me. And we should really be thinking about that in a real way, not in a theoretical, like, I don't feel comfortable with the idea that you have that right. I don't feel comfortable that people want to take away my rights.
As a physician, you know, you bring your data-driven approach to your policies, and that brings you a lot of credibility, you know, in healthcare, mental health, homelessness. Your approach to the populist ideas, such as healthcare and environmental reforms, I mean, they might clash, you know, with more moderate or conservative people, especially if your ideas are seen as too progressive. So balancing governance with, you know, the ambitious goals that you have could cause friction, you know, when you push back against a divided Congress. I'm thinking Congress is a little different than the Oregon legislature.
Yeah. That's what I hear. The reality is that iterative progress is meaningful. If you have an idea of where you're headed and you can continue to make progress, then you are moving towards the goal that you've set. So climate action, we are moving towards a goal of mitigating climate change. What we have started doing is working. The Inflation Reduction Act was one of the biggest international investments in climate change, infrastructure change that we've seen. So we can do hard things, even in a stepwise progress. What I, negotiating the land use laws, Senate Bill 100 in the 2023 session, making sure that we had land use laws that work for people and for the development of housing was one of the things I was tasked with. It's a very contentious issue. You have environmentalists and housing developers and, you know, people everywhere in between with a vested interest. I believe in transparency, having, you know, everyone at the table sharing their concerns. And what I asked people to come with was things that they must have, things that they couldn't support, and where they were able to agree. And what we ended up with was everyone got what they needed, but no one got everything they wanted. And I think that that's where durable policy is made, that it's not going to swing left and right depending on who's in the majority, that it's the right policy that people with, you know, different perspectives have negotiated on. That's hard work. And it also requires time. But for meaningful policy change, investing that time and that effort is going to pay in the long run. And we saw that. That bill went pretty smoothly through with our housing package because everyone had been at the table and nobody was trying to kill it as we moved it forward. So that upfront investment makes for a much smoother and long-term policy. And so how I show up is asking my Republican colleagues, like, what do you absolutely need? What can you not support? And then move from there. And having those cards on the table really helps the negotiation diffuse. It also builds trust when people who don't agree see that they're meaningfully engaging in negotiations. It really builds a ground for changing it in the end. And this happened with that bill, that some of the language that came through did not lead to the intended outcomes. And we all had heard those negotiations. So amending the bill was not an issue. Like, people were willing. They were like, yeah, that wasn't what we agreed to. So we need to make that change. If everyone's not in the same room, you don't have that shared understanding. So we need to put in the work to get good bills passed.
You told the Jewish Insider back in May of of this year that you oppose efforts to condition U.S. aid to Israel, but support a negotiated ceasefire and delivery of humanitarian aid. How do you balance that? Because at the most basic level, the military support the U.S. provides includes weapons that have been used against Gazans and now Lebanese. I mean, as you must know, there is a danger of the entire region exploding into a regional war that threatens to put the U.S. and Iran on a collision course. The new Iranian president has said he doesn't want war, but he cannot not support Hezbollah. Yeah. So how do you balance that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this is just as of yesterday, you know, ongoing issues. So number one, American values and principles need to be consistent across the world. Humanitarian rights and international law needs to guide our actions in defense aid spending or sharing. My principles on this haven't changed. I'm a physician. I'm a mother. It is absolutely horrendous to think about what happened on October 7th to the Israeli community, as well as what has continued and escalatingly happened to our Palestinian neighbors. We must take international multilateral action. This is not a situation that we can stand back and expect it to fix itself. This is, you know, decades of instability in the region that's coming to fruition. So how we navigate it is, I believe, multilateral negotiations with Iran, with Saudi Arabia, making sure that the region is bought into how we negotiate a peace deal. To do that, you have to have an immediate ceasefire and the famine and the humanitarian crisis that is truly expanding in the Middle East. I would also just share, Sudan is the most threatened community of people in the world, and we don't focus on that, which is conflicting for me, but we cannot forget about what's happening in Sudan right now. But if American aid is going to be defense aid, weapons are going to be shared, it should be based on the Leahy law that says, you know, if there's clear infractions of humanitarian or international law infractions, that we don't share the aid. And I think that that is where we have to enforce our own laws again, saying, you know, that one area or another should have increased restrictions on that aid is counter to our principles. We need to be consistent. And there's already a law saying what guides our offering of aid to people. We need to stand by those principles.
Well, as you know, I mean, Israel, every time there is an alleged incident of humanitarian violation, the Israeli military, the Israeli government says, okay, we're going to do an investigation. And it's investigation on top of investigation on top of investigation. And I would like to think that the Leahy law could actually be more than the paper that it's printed on.
Absolutely.
Why should voters of the 3rd District vote for you?
One, I've established myself as somebody that people can trust. I'll do what I say and say what I mean. I'm candid. You know, if I disagree with you, I'm not going to be coy about that. I'll share and then offer the opportunity for you to change my mind. So I am not someone who fears more information and a diversity of information coming my way that might change my mind. That is what science is. And so trust is built with mutual sharing of vulnerability. I will make myself vulnerable to the voters and say what I think and then offer the opportunity for them to impact my decisions over time. But being a physician, I think, you know, people have trusted me for a long time. I have integrity. I have a mission to serve. Being a science-based person should be something that people can challenge me based on data and we can have that conversation. And then the foundational issue is that I truly am there to take care of people, and I want to serve. This is not about me or, you know, I've got a great job. I don't need this for the money or anything else. It's because I grew up in a working class family, was offered opportunity, see that that's not available for people. I'm going to be one of few former union members in Congress. Like, I've truly come from the working class, and I think we need people who represent all different types of experiences and lifestyles in Congress. So people should trust me because I believe in our country. I believe that the system can do better, and I want it to be better for our working families, and everyone will benefit if our working families.
So tell me, what makes the 3rd Congressional District different from the other districts? What specifically can you tell me about the people and the aspirations of the 3rd District?
Yeah, so East Multnomah County is a huge portion and a very important part of this district. It's been underinvested in for decades, probably longer. We have a more youthful demographic in that district, a more diverse population, and certainly an underinvested. So that is going to be a focus. We need affordable childcare, good schools, housing that's affordable. The other things I can say, it's more labor union members in the third district than any part of the state. So working families are the backbone of the third congressional district. We also have, I would say, the most beautiful district. We've got the Gorge and Mount Hood and Hood River, but that also brings with it the challenges of having a beautiful place with unaffordable housing. So Hood River is the most unaffordable place to live in the state. It's one of the most unaffordable in the country. And that is because of the juxtaposition of beauty with rural lands where we as Oregonians have protected our farms and forests. So we have created a significant challenge. They're losing teachers in Hood River because people can't afford to live there. So I've been from Hood River to Gresham to East Portland. We've got very similar issues, but much more profoundly impacting people who are marginalized in East County and then our farmers and our working families in Hood River.
You've got a lot of big plate issues. First, you have a strong record on housing. You chaired the House Housing and Homelessness Committee, and you helped pass a $200 million bill to address homelessness, and your medical background lends credibility to your focus on mental health services for people experiencing homelessness. But the scale of homelessness in Oregon, particularly in Portland, is huge. And while you advocate for increased spending on housing, do you think that you might face challenges balancing immediate emergency situations with long-term housing development? I mean, because rapid action to resolve the crisis might conflict with your broader vision for systemic reforms.
Yeah, so we did make enormous investments, almost $2 billion over the last two biennia in housing in Oregon. We have a governor who this has been her passion and her focus, and her leadership has been very impactful. So the housing investments that we're making are multifaceted. We are looking at production. This is a numbers game. If we had sufficient housing available, it wouldn't be so unaffordable. It's basic capital market economy issues. But we also have failed to invest in the mental health and the supportive housing services that people need. You know, those suffering with addiction or disabilities or domestic violence. You know, we have folks in our communities who you can't just give them an apartment and expect them to be successful. So we have made investments, but unfortunately, we're reaping the rewards, if you call it that, of not investing in those services and housing for over 40 years.
I'm curious about that. Why do you feel that Measure 110, even though it was intended with a good outcome, it was so poorly implemented?
Because we're really good at making laws and really poor at executing them. And I'll just say that and double down on it. We pass laws and then we put on top of it other laws and we continue to pass laws, but we don't go back and check our work. And it's one of the frustrations that I have as a scientist is if our hypothesis is that decriminalizing personal use of illicit drugs with services is going to help all of us. Treating addiction as the public health issue, the true health, chronic health issue that it is, then we should have come to the absolute assessment that you have to have those services available before you decriminalize it for it to be effective. We thought about the policy, but not about the implementation as we moved forward. And it's because it's hard to get good policy be passed and implemented. You have to have the systems and the bureaucracy all in alignment. And unfortunately, that's not what we've done. You know, and you can see this over and over again. I will also say that voters and people are impatient. You know, when you pass a good policy, it takes time for that policy to actually reap the rewards of the change. And oftentimes, you know, people will point fingers and say a year later, we'll see it didn't work. It hasn't even started yet. And some of that was true with the Measure 110 investments. It took time for those investments to really start showing hope. And I have a lot of hope with the investments those are making, but those should have happened before the decriminalization. The last thing I'll say is that we also didn't think about the fact that when illicit drug use is illegal, that you don't need to have a law saying you can't use it in public because it's illegal to use it no matter where you are. But when we decriminalized it, we didn't think about the fact that we needed to make sure that we agreed that it was okay to use it in public property and in parks. Like, that is the number one thing that I think was really hard for our community, was to, you know, we understand people have drug addiction, but when it's in their home and in the privacy of a personal space, it's very different from a public perspective mm-hmm. than when it's, you know, in front of children in a park or along a school route. And so I think that was also on all of us, the people who wrote the ballot measure, and then those of us who were accountable for how it rolled out. We didn't take care of that, and I think it was short-sighted.
I've talked to a lot of candidates. I'm talking to a lot of Portland City Council candidates. I plan to be talking to a lot of Multnomah County Commission candidates. And I hear this theme running through some of their thoughts about citizen engagement. And that is, citizens need to engage. This is new. When I hear them say, people have to show up. So I guess the question I'm asking is, do you think that there has been a problem with people showing up?
There is a problem with people showing up, but I think it's because the system has not lended itself to people being able to show up. For instance, we have public testimony available on all bills at the Oregon legislature, but it was too hard for real people to show up. You can't take a day off of work and find childcare for your kid, and you may speak a language that you don't even have the opportunity to have interpretation for. You may not even know when it's available or when that bill is up. Like, people can't show up if they don't know what we're doing. So our accountability is to make information available in a language and in a way that everyone can access, and to ask for that input. It's not about people coming to us. It should be about us going to the people. And people showing up, I think, is quite frankly, or the criticism that people aren't showing up is on us because we've made it too hard. People care about their communities. But when you're struggling to survive, you're not going to go to a city council meeting that lasts for too many hours, by mm-hmm. the way. So we need to create a system where it is expected that I show up in the farm worker camps and in the public schools and park rows and, you know, have town halls and share how to get that information to me personally, but also when we have important legislation before us, whether it's at the city, the county, or the state or federal level, people should have the ability to weigh in a meaningful, and so that is on us to do better.
Maxine Dexter is a